Hello and welcome. One of the most harmful features of American life today is a routine lack of serious regard for a self-consistent principle and a corresponding lack of regard for truthful and reality-based history. It's like a video clip on permanent replay. Again and again, politicians of both major parties support policies of presidents of their own party, such as massive deficit spending and illegal wars, that they denounce and criticize when carried out by a president of the rival party. Republican politicians regularly criticize policies of a Democratic president that they are happy to support when carried out by a Republican in the White House. And Democratic politicians regularly criticize policies of a Republican president that they support when one of their own is in the White House. It's no wonder that Americans with an attention span of more than a few minutes and a memory of more than a few months are disgusted with this country's political leaders. Many Americans, including nearly all of the country's politicians, whether they call themselves Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal, embrace a romanticized, distorted, and mythologized narrative of American history that suits their own prejudices and personal interests, and one that is also, of course, consistent with the prevailing outlook pushed by the conformist American media. This is particularly true of how we are trained and expected to view World War II, the most terrible conflict in modern history, and especially the American role in the war, and therefore the record of President Franklin Roosevelt and his government. Many Americans who regard themselves as patriotic or conservative and who angrily criticize President Obama and his administration for expanding the role of the U.S. federal government, for deceiving the public, and for violating American laws and the U.S. Constitution are quite content to ignore, excuse, or justify the far more drastic expansion of federal government power and authority by President Franklin Roosevelt and his administration, the great campaign of deceit and lies of the Roosevelt government in the years before and during World War II, and the gross violations of American law and the U.S. Constitution by Roosevelt and his administration during those years. In this broadcast, I'll be taking a look at President Roosevelt and his policies, especially during the World War II era, a record of deceit, lies, and lawlessness that the U.S. media, American educators, and U.S. politicians of both major parties either ignore or distort. When Franklin Roosevelt was campaigning for the presidency in 1932, he pledged and promised that, if elected, he would balance the budget and reduce federal government spending. Well, his record shortly after taking office showed that he had very little regard for those pledges made as a candidate. And President Roosevelt acted quickly to carry out and introduce policies that were extraordinarily sweeping in their vast expansion of federal government authority and power. A few examples. A few weeks after taking office, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 6102 that made it illegal for Americans to own gold. From 1933 to 1975, it was illegal for Americans to own gold except for private jewelry, personal jewelry, and the gold in one's teeth. In 1933, President Roosevelt ordered that all Americans who held gold in the form of gold coins and bullion had to turn it in to the Federal Reserve banks at the stipulated price of $20.67 an ounce, an extraordinary expansion of federal governmental authority and power. And for more than 40 years, this ban on owning gold was held in place in the United States of America. Shortly after taking office, President Roosevelt ordered the closing of all banks in the United States. And they were only opened again after federal authorities determined that they were sound enough to be reopened. Again, an extraordinarily vast expanse of federal government authority and power. During the Roosevelt years, the government introduced a compulsory retirement insurance program, the Social Security system, that even today, very few conservatives would talk about dismantling or doing away with. Although at the time, American conservatives vehemently denounced the Social Security system in words and rhetoric that echo the denunciation today of the national health care plan proposed during the Clinton administration and more recently introduced and proposed by the Barack Obama administration. But the Social Security Administration and the Social Security system set up under the Roosevelt years represented an enormous increase in the intrusiveness and the role of the federal government in the lives of the American people. It was also during those years that the federal government expanded its authority enormously in the form of the Tennessee Valley Authority and became responsible for building and maintaining a vast hydroelectric power system. The federal government became, in effect, a public utility corporation. Also set up during those years was the Works Project Administration, a public works program far greater than anything that had existed in the United States before that time. It was also during those years that the Roosevelt administration expanded federal government authority in the so-called Agricultural Adjustment Act that even ordered farmers in the United States, told them what they could grow and what they could not grow. There were restrictions on what farmers could plant and grow in their own land. One of the most expansive government programs during those years was the so-called National Industrial Recovery Act and setting up a huge organization called the National Recovery Administration, which more or less forced businesses around the United States or pressured businesses to set prices and wages. This expansion of government power and authority by the federal government was so great that eventually even the National Recovery Act and National Recovery Administration was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States. It was also during the Roosevelt years that Roosevelt ordered for the first time the FBI to snoop and investigate the private lives of American citizens in a way that had not been done before. But the point here is that the expansion of federal government authority and power during the Franklin Roosevelt administration was far, far more drastic, more extensive than anything that any recent American president has undertaken, has undergone. And although many conservatives criticize the Barack Obama administration for expanding federal government and power, it's nothing compared to the enormous expanse of that power during the Franklin Roosevelt administration. But the main focus of this broadcast is not on the expansion of the power and authority of federal government during the Roosevelt years. It's on the record of the Roosevelt administration in World War II. World War II is routinely portrayed in the United States as the one war that, above all others, was justified and necessary. Whatever doubts or misgivings Americans may have had about their country's role in Iraq, Vietnam, or other overseas conflicts, or whatever arguments there may be today about the wisdom of U.S. involvement in the Afghanistan war, for example, most accept that the sacrifices made by the U.S. in World War II, especially in defeating Hitler's Germany, were entirely justified and worthwhile. Well, the simplistic view that World War II represents the one good war in American history, the one unquestionably noble cause for which Americans fought, is not only simplistic, it's inaccurate and wrong. If nothing else, consider these points. The most important military ally of the United States during World War II, and indeed in all of U.S. history, was also the most tyrannical and oppressive regime of its time, the Soviet Union. Without American support during World War II, it's questionable if the Soviet Union even would have survived. The second most important American ally in World War II was the British Empire, which held more people under oppression than any other government, any other regime in world history. That is, America's most important allies in World War II were the world's foremost imperialist power, Britain and the British Empire, and the world's cruelest tyranny at the time, the Soviet Union. But the record of the Roosevelt administration goes beyond even these more obvious points. Much has been written about Roosevelt's campaign of deception and lies in getting the United States to intervene in the Second World War prior to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941. Roosevelt's aid to Britain and the Soviet Union in violation of American neutrality and international law, his acts of war against Germany in the Atlantic in 1941 in an effort to provoke a German declaration of war against the United States, his authorization of a vast dirty tricks campaign against U.S. citizens by British intelligence agents in violation of the U.S. Constitution, and his provocations and ultimatums against Japan, which brought on the attack against Pearl Harbor, all this is extensively documented and reasonably well known. Not so well known is the story of Roosevelt's enormous responsibility for the outbreak of the Second World War itself. Prior to the outbreak of hostilities in Europe in September 1939, President Roosevelt engaged in a secret and illegal campaign to provoke war in Europe. Above all, in his efforts to pressure Britain, France, and Poland into going to war against Germany in 1938 and 1939. President Roosevelt not only criminally involved in America in a war which had already engulfed Europe, he bears responsibility before history for the outbreak, bears some responsibility in history before for the outbreak of the most destructive war of all time. Now, much of the important documents that show Roosevelt's campaign are contained in British and Polish archives. Some of the most important documents in this regard are reports by Polish diplomats to the Polish Foreign Office about the efforts by American officials to get Poland to go to war against Germany in 1939 or refuse to carry out any kind of compromise over the Danzig issue in 1939, which was the immediate cause of war and hostility in September 1939. On February 9th, 1938, that is more than a year before the outbreak of war in Europe in September 1939, the Polish ambassador in Washington, Count Jerzy Potocki, wrote a remarkable report to the foreign minister in Warsaw on the American war psychosis of the Roosevelt administration and the important role of the organized Jewish community in the United States in pushing for war. In this report of February 1938, Ambassador Potocki wrote, and I'm quoting, The pressure of the Jews on President Roosevelt and on the State Department is becoming ever more powerful. The Jews are right now the leaders in creating a war psychosis which would plunge the entire world into war and bring about general catastrophe. This mood is becoming more and more apparent. In their definition of democratic states, the Jews have also created real chaos. They have mixed together the idea of democracy and communism, and above all, raised the banner of burning hatred against Nazism. This hatred has become a frenzy. It is propagated everywhere and by every means, in theaters, in the cinema, and in the press. The Germans are portrayed as a nation living under the arrogance of Hitler, which wants to conquer the world and drown all of humanity in an ocean of blood. In conversations with Jewish press representatives, I've repeatedly come up against the inexorable and convinced view that war is inevitable. This international Jewry exploits every means of propaganda to oppose any tendency towards any kind of consolidation and understanding between nations. In this way, the conviction is growing steadily but surely in public opinion here that the Germans and their satellites in the form of fascism are enemies who must be subdued by the democratic world. A few months later, in November 1938, again, this is long before even the outbreak of war in Europe in September 1939, Ambassador Potocki sent a report to Warsaw which discussed in some detail a conversation between himself and William Bullitt, who was a high-ranking American diplomat. He was the U.S. ambassador to Paris and a very close personal intimate of Franklin Roosevelt, and was an important official in carrying out Roosevelt's policies. William Bullitt happened to be back in Washington at the time, and Ambassador Potocki, in his report in November 1938, wrote this, quote, "The day before yesterday, I had a long conversation with Ambassador Bullitt, who is here on vacation. He began by remarking that friendly relations existed between himself and Polish Ambassador Lukasiewicz in Paris, whose company he greatly enjoyed. Since Bullitt regularly informs President Roosevelt about the international situation in Europe, and particularly about Russia, great attention is given to his reports by President Roosevelt and the State Department. About Germany and Chancellor Hitler, he, that is Bullitt, spoke with great vehemence and strong hatred. He said that only force and ultimately a war would put an end to the insane future German expansionism. In reply to my question whether the United States would take part in such a war, he, that is Bullitt, said, undoubtedly yes, but only after Great Britain and France had let loose first. Feeling in the United States was so intense against Nazism and Hitlerism that a psychosis already prevails today among Americans similar to that before America's declaration of war against Germany in 1917. In January 1939, again months before the outbreak of hostilities, Ambassador Potocki wrote a report in Washington which dealt with the domestic situation in the United States, which is very revealing. Potocki wrote this, quote, "The feeling now prevailing in the United States is marked by a growing hatred of fascism and above all of Chancellor Hitler and everything connected with Nazism. Propaganda is mostly in the hands of the Jews, who control almost 100% radio, film, daily and periodical press. Although this propaganda is extremely coarse and presents Germany as black as possible, above all, religious persecution and concentration camps are exploited, this propaganda is nevertheless extremely effective, since the public here is completely ignorant and knows nothing of the situation in Europe. Right now, most Americans regard Chancellor Hitler and Nazism as the greatest evil and greatest danger threatening the world." He went on, "Besides this propaganda, a war psychosis is being artificially created. The American people are told that peace in Europe is hanging only by a thread and that war is unavoidable. At the same time, the American people are unequivocally told that in case of a world war, America must also take an active part in order to defend the slogans of freedom and democracy in the world." President Roosevelt was the first to express hatred against fascism. In doing so, he was serving a double purpose. First, he wanted to divert the attention of the American people from domestic political problems, especially the problem of the struggle between capital and labor. Second, by creating a war psychosis and by spreading rumors about danger threatening Europe, he wanted to get the American people to accept an enormous armament program which exceeds the defense requirements of the United States. As to point two, I can only say that President Roosevelt, as a clever political player and an expert of the American mentality, speedily steered public attention away from the domestic situation to fasten it on to foreign policy. The way to achieve this was simple. One needed, on the one hand, to conjure up a war menace hanging over the world because of Chancellor Hitler, and on the other hand, to create a specter by babbling about an attack of the totalitarian states against the United States. He went on, "These groups of people who occupy the highest positions in the American government and who want to pose as representatives of true Americanism and defenders of democracy are, in the last analysis, connected by unbreakable ties with international Jewry. For this Jewish international, which above all is concerned with the interests of its race, to portray the President of the United States as the idealist champion on human rights was a very clever move. In this manner, they have created a dangerous hotbed for hatred and hostility in this hemisphere and divided the world into two hostile camps. The entire issue is worked out in a masterly manner. Roosevelt has given the foundation for activating American foreign policy and simultaneously has been procuring enormous military stocks for the coming war for which the Jews are striving very consciously. With regard to domestic policy, it is very convenient to divert public attention from anti-Semitism, which is constantly growing in the United States, by talking about the necessity of defending religion and individual liberty against the onslaught of fascism." Now, these reports by the Polish ambassador are especially insightful and valuable because they are made by a government, or by an envoy of a government, that was not particularly pro-German, but nevertheless are revealing about the real situation in the United States at the time. It's noteworthy that even in 1938, the grip of the Jewish, organized Jewish community on the media in the United States was so great that it was able to have, as Ambassador Plotkowski reports from Washington, this enormous effect on American public opinion in encouraging a psychosis of war against Germany by the United States and reflecting the policies and the outlook of the Roosevelt administration during that time. Well, we'll take a break at this point and return in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. Welcome back. When we went on break, I was quoting from secret dispatches by the Polish ambassador in Washington, Count Jerzy Potocki, written in 1938 and 1939 to the Polish foreign minister in Warsaw, confirming the efforts by the Roosevelt administration to pushing for war against Germany. even before the outbreak of conflict in September 1939 over the Danzig issue with Poland. The reports by the Polish ambassador in Washington are also confirmed by reports by other Polish envoys in Paris and London, which also show the efforts by the Roosevelt administration to push for war against Germany at a time when Germany not only was no threat to Britain or France or to certainly the United States, but was carrying out policies meant to ensure peace with all of those countries. Ambassador Potocki's documents are just one of a number of documents that are quoted in a lengthy article which I wrote some years ago that's posted on the IHR website. In this broadcast, I'm only able to have time to quote from a few of these dispatches, and only of those from the Polish ambassador in Washington to Warsaw. But the substance of the what the Polish ambassador reported from Washington, insofar as President Roosevelt was pushing for war long before there was even any outbreak of hostilities in Europe, was also confirmed in an important dispatch written in September 1938 by the British ambassador to Washington, Sir Ronald Lindsay. During his 3 years of service in Washington, the veteran British diplomat had developed little regard for America's leaders. He considered Roosevelt an amiable and impressionable lightweight. On September 19, 1938, that is a year before the outbreak of war in Europe, Roosevelt called Ambassador Lindsay to a very secret meeting at the White House. At the beginning of their long conversation, according to Lindsay's confidential dispatch to London, Roosevelt, and I'm quoting from the report by Ambassador Lindsay, Roosevelt emphasized the necessity of absolute secrecy. Nobody must know I had seen him, and he himself would tell nobody of the interview. I gathered not even the State Department. The two men discussed some secondary matters before Roosevelt got to the main point of the conference. Quote, "This is the very secret part of his communication, and it must not be known to anyone that he has even breathed a suggestion." Unquote. The president told the ambassador that if news of the conversation was ever made public, it could mean his impeachment. And no wonder, because what President Roosevelt proposed was a cynically brazen but harebrained scheme to violate the U.S. Constitution and dupe the American people. President Roosevelt told the British envoy that if Britain and France would find themselves forced to war against Germany, that was his words, the United States would ultimately also join. Now, this is extraordinary because the United States was officially neutral, and President Roosevelt publicly was claiming the United States wanted peace and that he wanted peace. But this would require, Roosevelt went on, some clever maneuvering. Britain and France, he said, should impose a total blockade against Germany without actually declaring war, and force other countries, including neutral countries in Europe, to abide by this blockade. This would certainly, he hoped, provoke some kind of German military response, but it would also free Britain and France from having to actually declare war. Roosevelt said that for propaganda purposes, the blockade must be based on the loftiest humanitarian grounds and on the desire to wage hostilities with minimum of suffering and the least possible loss of life and property, and yet bring the enemy to his knees. Roosevelt conceded that this would involve aerial bombardment, but he went on, amazingly, quote, "bombing from the air was not the method of hostilities which caused great loss of life," unquote. The important point, Roosevelt said, was to call it defensive measures or anything plausible, but avoid actual declaration of war. The reason for this, Roosevelt went on, was that he believed he could thereby talk the American people into supporting war against Germany, including shipments of weapons to Britain and France, by insisting that the United States was still technically neutral in a non-declared conflict. I'm quoting now from the report. This method of conducting war by blockade would, in his, Roosevelt's, opinion, meet with approval of the United States if its humanitarian purpose were strongly emphasized. Now, this is extraordinary, astonishing. It's not only utterly illegal, utterly in violation of the U.S. Constitution, but is confirmation by the British ambassador of the duplicity, the deceit, the lawlessness of the Roosevelt administration that Roosevelt manifested in other ways as well. And yet, today in America, American politicians, educators, and so forth regard Franklin Roosevelt as a great American president, the leader of America during what is routinely regarded in this country as the good war. The good war of the United States. The substance of what was reported by both the Polish and British ambassador in Washington about Franklin Roosevelt's effort to provoke war in Europe was also confirmed some years after the war by the French foreign minister, Georges Bonnet. He was the French foreign minister in 1939, and he later confirmed the role of William Bullitt, Roosevelt's envoy in Paris, as Roosevelt's deputy in pushing his France into war against Germany. In a letter written some years later, Bonnet wrote, "One thing is certain is that Bullitt in 1939 did everything he could to make France enter the war." Another important confirmation of the crucial role of Roosevelt and Jews in pushing Britain into war comes from the diary of James Forrestal, who was the first U.S. Secretary of Defense. In his diary for December 27, 1945, Forrestal wrote, and I'm quoting here, quote, "Played golf today with former Ambassador Joe Kennedy." Now, Joe Kennedy was the U.S. ambassador in London in 1939 and 1940. "I asked him," that is Kennedy, "about his conversations with Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain from 1938 on. He said Chamberlain's position in 1938 was that England had nothing with which to fight and that she could not risk going to war with Hitler. Kennedy's view that Hitler would have fought Russia without any later conflict with England if it had not been for William Bullitt's urging on Roosevelt in the summer of 1939 that the Germans must be face down about Poland. Neither the French nor the British would have made Poland a cause of war if it had not been for the constant needling from Washington. Bullitt," he said, "kept telling Roosevelt that the Germans wouldn't fight, Kennedy that they would, and that they would overrun Europe. Chamberlain," he says, the British Prime Minister, "Chamberlain," he says, "stated that America and the world Jews had forced England into the war," unquote. President Roosevelt's policies were more than just dishonest. They were criminal. The Constitution of the United States grants authority only to Congress to make war and peace, and Congress had passed several major laws specifically to ensure U.S. neutrality in case of war in Europe. Roosevelt continually violated his oath as president to uphold the Constitution. If his secret policies had been known, the public demand for his impeachment very possibly would have been unstoppable. Now, those who defend Roosevelt's record argue that he lied to the American public for their own good, that he broke the law for lofty principles. His deceit is considered permissible because the cause was noble, while similar deception by Presidents Johnson or Nixon or George Bush or Obama, to name just a few, is not. Now, this is, of course, a hypocritical double standard, and the argument doesn't speak very well for the democratic system. It implies that the American people are too stupid to understand their own best interests. And it further suggests that the best form of government is a kind of benevolent, liberal, democratic dictatorship. I was referring to the campaign of the Roosevelt administration of lies and deceit for war. One of the high points of this campaign was in speeches given by Roosevelt in 1941, in which he told the American public over and over about the supposed danger to this country represented by Germany and by the Hitler government. This, in fact, is these were brazen lies, a gross distortion of the truth to panic the American public into supporting Roosevelt's policies of war. Roosevelt, during this period of time, also carried out policies that were completely in violation both of U.S. law and U.S. neutrality law and of international law. During this time, the American government gave military aid to both Britain and to the Soviet Union, even though the United States technically was a neutral country, and the American law and international law prohibited such one-sided help to one side or another during wartime. Roosevelt claimed that the German leaders were bent on what he called world domination, and he proclaimed in May a state of what he called unlimited national emergency. And finally, Roosevelt ordered in July a so-called, a shoot-on-sight order to U.S. naval warships to attack German and Italian vessels on the high seas. Now, this was a blatant act of war, an act of aggression against a country with which the United States supposedly was at peace. One of the most remarkable addresses by President Roosevelt in this regard is his speech in October 1941, his so-called Navy Day speech. In this Navy Day address of October 27th, he used highly emotional language to deceive the American public about the real situation in Europe and U.S. relations with Germany. As part of his effort to convince Americans that Germany was a threat to their security, he made a startling announcement. He said, "Hitler has often protested that his plans for conquest do not extend across the Atlantic Ocean. I have in my possession a secret map made in Germany by Hitler's government, by the planners of the New World Order. It is a map of South America and a part of Central America as Hitler proposes to reorganize it." This map, and the president explained, showed South America, as well as what he called our great lifeline, the Panama Canal, divided into five vassal states under German domination. Roosevelt said, "That map, my friends, makes clear the Nazi design not only against South America, but against the United States as well." Roosevelt went on in his speech to reveal that he also had in his possession what he called another document made in Germany by Hitler's government. It is a detailed plan to abolish all existing religions, Catholic, Protestant, Mohammedan, Hindu, Buddhist, and Jewish alike, which Germany will impose on a dominated world if Hitler wins. Roosevelt continued, "The property of all churches will be seized by the Reich and its puppets. The cross and all other symbols of religion are to be forbidden. The clergy are to be forever silenced under penalty of the concentration camps. In the place of the churches of our civilization, there will be set up an international Nazi church, a church which will be served by orators sent out by the Nazi government. In the place of the Bible, the words of Mein Kampf will be imposed and enforced as holy writ, and in place of the cross of Christ will be put two symbols, the swastika and the naked sword. Roosevelt emphasized the importance of his alarming claims. Let us well ponder, he said, these grim truths which I have told you of the present and future plans of Hitlerism. All Americans, he went on, are faced with a choice between the kind of world we want to live in and the kind of world which Hitler and his hordes would impose on us. Well, in Berlin, the German government quickly responded to Roosevelt's speech with a statement that categorically rejected the president's accusations. Now, the full story behind Roosevelt's claims did not emerge until many years later. The map that he referred to did exist, but it was a forgery produced by British Intelligence Service. William Stevenson, whose code name was Intrepid, who was chief of British intelligence operations in North America, passed on this map to U.S. intelligence chief William Donovan, who gave it to Roosevelt. In a memoir published in late 1984, wartime British agent Ivar Bryce claimed credit for thinking up the secret map scheme. And, of course, the other supposed documents cited by Roosevelt purporting to outline German plans to abolish the world's religions was just as fraudulent as the so-called secret map. It should be regarded as absurd and incredible on its face. But the American public in 1941 overwhelmingly accepted as truthful their president's fantastic and alarmist claims. Few Americans could believe that their chief executive might be lying, certainly on such a brazen scale, while the Nazis, so-called, might be telling the truth. In his Navy Day address and in other speeches, President Franklin Roosevelt succeeded in his main goal, which was to frighten the public into supporting or at least tolerating his campaign to push the U.S. further into war. Now, many Americans are understandably outraged by the deceit and falsehood of President George W. Bush and his administration in seeking public support for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. But the memory of many Americans is very short, and the outrage of Americans very limited. Few Americans today even bother to talk about or are concerned about the deceit of George W. Bush and his administration in lying to promote war against Iraq in 2003. And George W. Bush is not, there's no demand by even Democratic leaders for punishing him in any way, or shaming him at least. But as we have seen, presidential deception to justify war did not start with George W. Bush. Americans who express admiration for the U.S. role in World War II and for Franklin Roosevelt's presidential leadership have little moral right to complain when presidents follow Roosevelt's example and lead the country into war by breaking the law, subverting the Constitution, and lying to the people. If the history of war and conflict teaches us anything, it is the danger of arrogance and hubris, the danger of going to war because a nation's leaders are convinced of their own righteousness or have persuaded themselves and the public that a foreign country should be attacked because its government or society is not merely alien, hostile, or threatening, but evil. This is perhaps the most harmful legacy of America's national mythology about World War II. the notion that worthwhile or justifiable wars are fought against countries headed by supposedly evil regimes. And it is that very outlook that moved President Bush to refer to his war on terrorism as a crusade, and in a major speech to proclaim a U.S. foreign policy dedicated to ending tyranny in the world. How a nation views the past is not a trivial or merely academic exercise. Our perception of history profoundly shapes our actions in the present, often with grave consequences for the future. Drawing conclusions from our understanding of the past, we make or support policies that greatly impact many lives. The familiar American portrayal of World War II and the good war mythology of the U.S. role in it is not merely bad history. It has helped greatly to support and justify a series of arrogant U.S. foreign policy adventures with harmful consequences for both America and the world. To bring this to our situation here in America today, it is ridiculous to assume that American leaders who have a track record of lying about foreign affairs are going to do and act in a way that is best for the American public in domestic policy as well. Because the world is smaller than it is, our involvement in foreign wars is all the more harmful when they are unnecessary than has ever been the case in the past. And as bad as the situation was in 2003 when the United States invaded Iraq, the situation is far worse today because the United States is today essentially a broke country. Going to wars overseas in the name of democracy or freedom or because of powerful pressures and influence and media by a small minority in this country is all the more disastrous at a time when America faces such looming, such awesome, such grave problems here at home. But an understanding of the duplicity, the deceit, and the pattern of lies by American politicians in going to war and carrying out deceitful policies like this requires an understanding of the track record of this, most notably, most obviously, in the most important war in world history, the Second World War, and above all, in carefully understanding the legacy of the United States in the so-called Good War, the record of the Franklin Roosevelt administration. It's very difficult to talk objectively or dispassionately about World War II because of the enormous propaganda in the years since, above all because the war against Hitler's Germany is considered more justifiable and more righteous than any other conflict because of the portrayal in our media of the Hitler government is bad because its policies were anti-Jewish. But this kind of moralism makes it very difficult because we cannot look at the past and not able to look at the past in an objective way to look at the present with detachment and sobriety and honesty in our own time. Well, that concludes this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. I welcome comments and suggestions and questions. Write to me at weber@ihr.org by email, and also I urge you to check out the IHR website at ihr.org.